had breakout sessions and the afterthought party at Jurvetson's home. This was just 4 months before he would leave the firm amid allegations of misconduct. In photos of the party posted to a private group on Facebook, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, a longtime friend of Jurvetson's, appears wearing a black armor-like costume adorned with silver spikes and chains. Jurvetson is sporting a feather vest and hat. Google co-founder Sergey Brin was also there, bare-chested in a vest, as was Jonathan Tao, Justin Kalbeck's business partner, who later referred to the party as magic in a Facebook post. Ironically, the gathering was held just a week after sexual harassment allegations against Kalbeck had been reported, but that didn't seem to discourage certain guests from participating in heavy petting in the open. "It was in the middle of the binary thing," Jane Doe told me, referring to the scandal at the VC firm, "and it was all so ridiculous." Doe found herself on the floor with two other couples, including a male entrepreneur and his wife. The living room had been blanketed in plush white faux fur and pillows, where, as the evening wore on, several people lay down and started stroking one another, Doe says, in what became a sizable cuddle puddle. Photos reveal a group of men and women lying close together, kissing and massaging one another. In a later Facebook comment, Jurvetson referred to one snapshot of the scene as, quote, "deep cuddle." One venture capitalist, dressed up as a bunny, it's unclear how this fit into the edge-of-the-earth theme, offered Jane Doe some powder in a plastic bag. It was Molly. "They said it will just make you feel relaxed and you're going to like being touched," Doe recounted to me. Nervous, she dipped her finger into the powder and put it in her mouth. Soon, her guard dropped. Then, the male founder asked if he could kiss her. "It was so weird," she said. "I'm like, your wife is right there. Is she okay with this?" The founder's wife acknowledged that, yes, she was okay with it. Jane Doe, who considers herself fairly adventurous and open-minded, kissed the founder, then became uncomfortable, feeling as if she had been pressured or targeted. "I don't know what I'm doing. I feel really stupid. I'm drugged up because I'd never taken it before, and he knew I'd never taken it," she recalled. She tried to escape to a different area of the party. "I felt gross because I had participated in making out with him, and then he kept trying to find me, and I kept trying to run away and hide. I remember saying to him, 'Aren't people going to wonder?' And he said, 'The people that know me know what's going on, and the people that don't, I don't really care.'" Before dawn, she jumped into her car and left. "What's not okay about this scene is that it is so money and power dominated. It's a problem because it's an abuse of power. I would never do it again," she said. While this particular woman felt ambushed, at more private affairs, if it's your first time, a friend might fill you in on what you're signing up for, and you're expected to keep it to yourself. You know that if you do drugs with someone you work with, you shouldn't mention it to anyone. And the same goes with sex. In other words, we're not hiding anything, but actually, we kind of are. You get invited only if you can be trusted, and if you're going to play ball. You can choose not to hook up with a specific someone, but you can't not hook up with anybody because that would be voyeurism. So if you don't participate, don't come in, says one frequent attendee, whom I'll call Founder X, an ambitious world-traveling entrepreneur. This is the same general spirit at play in the Orgy Dome at Burning Man, popular among techies. "No spectators" is the slogan out on the playa, and so it is back home. They don't see themselves as predatory, of course. When they look in the mirror, they see individuals setting a new paradigm of behavior by pushing the boundaries of social mores and values. What's making this possible is the same progressiveness and open-mindedness that allowed us to be creative and disruptive about ideas, Founder X told me. When I asked him about Jane Doe's experience, he said, "This is a private party where powerful people want to get together, and there are a lot of women and a lot of people who are fucked up. At any party, there can be a situation where people cross the line. Somebody fucked up, somebody crossed the line, but that's not an indictment on the cuddle puddle, that's an indictment on crossing the line. Doesn't that happen anywhere?" It's worth asking, however, if these sexual adventurers are so progressive, why do these parties seem to lean so heavily toward male heterosexual fantasies? Women are often expected to be involved in threesomes that include other women. Male, gay, and bisexual behavior is conspicuously absent. "Oddly, it's completely unthinkable that guys would be bisexual or curious," says one VC who attends and is married. I'll call him Married VC. "It's a total double standard." In other words, at these parties, men don't make out with other men. And, outside of the new types of drugs, These stories might have come out of the Playboy Mansion circa 1972. Regardless, a select few at the very top believe it's their obligation to tear down traditional sexual expectations. They're just expressing who they are. Founder X summed it up this way. You build your own team, and you get to build your own reality. Why wouldn't that mentality spill over into your sexual life? I had a wide-ranging conversation with Twitter co-founder Evan Williams about the peculiar mixture of audacity, eccentricity, and wealth that swirls in Silicon Valley. Williams, who is married with two kids, became an internet celebrity thanks to his first company, Blogger. He pointed out that he was never single, well-known, and rich at the same time, and he isn't part of this scene, but recognizes the motivations of his peers. This is a strange place that has created incredible things in the world and therefore attracts these types of people and enables these types of people. How could it be anything but weird and dramatic and people on the edge testing everything? On the one hand, he said, if you thought like everyone else, you can't invent the future. Yet also warned that sometimes this is a recipe for disaster. Rich men expecting casual sexual access to women is anything but a new paradigm. But many of the A-listers in Silicon Valley have something unique in common. A lonely adolescence devoid of contact with the opposite sex. Married VC described his teenage life as years of playing computer games and not going on a date until he was 20 years old. Now, to his amazement, he finds himself in a circle of trusted and adventurous tech friends with the money and resources to explore their every desire. After years of restriction and longing, he is living a fantasy, and his wife is right there with him. In fact, they've introduced several newbies, including Founder X, to this brave new world. Married VC's story, that his current voraciousness is explained by his sexual deprivation in adolescence, is one I hear a lot in Silicon Valley. They are finally getting theirs. Founder Hounders. There is an often told story that Silicon Valley is filled with women looking to cash in by marrying wealthy tech moguls. Whether there really is a significant number of such women is debatable. The story about them is alive and well, however, at least among the wealthy men who fear they might fall victim. In fact, these guys even have a term for the women who pursue them, founder hounders. When I asked Founder X whether these men are taking advantage of women by feeding them inhibition-melting drugs at sex parties, he replied that, on the contrary, it's women who are taking advantage of him and his tribe, preying on them for their money. On their way up to a potential multi-million-dollar payout, younger founders report that more and more women seem to become mysteriously attracted to them, no matter how awkward, uncool, or unattractive they may be. Alexis Ohanian, who co-founded Reddit, remembers going to bars with his co-founder, Steve Huffman, in the early days before their company was well-known. They'd be proudly wearing t-shirts bearing the Reddit logo, but they had no luck with the ladies. As Reddit became more recognizable, however, the t-shirt attracted more and more attention, until eventually Ohanian stopped wearing any Reddit-branded swag. In fact, when he went on dates, he wouldn't mention Reddit at all. I would just try to avoid the conversation to see how long I could go before they found out where I worked, Ohanian says. Of course, the internet makes it impossible to hide such information for long. Fuck you, I can't believe you founded Reddit, one woman texted him after a few dates. Whether she was impressed or felt deceived was a little unclear. Ohanian solved this problem by marrying someone even more famous than he is, the tennis phenomenon Serena Williams. However many founder hounders exist, the idea of these women lives large in the minds of Silicon Valley founders, who often trade stories about the women they've dated. As Founder X puts it, we'll say whether some girl is a fucking gold digger or not, so we know who to avoid. When I tell her this, Ava, a young female entrepreneur, rolls her eyes. According to Ava, who asked me to disguise her real identity, and has dated several founders, it's the men, not the women, who seem obsessed with displays of wealth and privilege. She tells of being flown to exotic locations, put up in fancy hotels, and other ways rich men have used their money to woo her. Backing up Ava's view are the profiles one finds on dating apps where men routinely brag about their tech jobs or startups. In their online profiles, men are all but saying, "Hello, would you like to come up to my loft and see my stock options?" In Ava's experience, however, once men like this land a woman, they're quick to throw her back. After a few extravagant dates, Ava says she'll initiate a conversation about where the tryst is going. The men have then ended things, several using the same explanation. They say, "I'm still catching up. I lost my virginity when I was 25, Ava tells me. And I'll say, "Well, you're 33 now. Are we all caught up yet?" In any other context, these fancy dates would be romantic, but instead it's charged because no one would fuck them in high school. I honestly think what they want is a do-over because women wouldn't bone them until now. Ava's jaundiced view of newly wealthy moguls would be funny if their gold digger obsession didn't mask something serious. The claim of being stalked by women often becomes an excuse used by some tech stars to justify their own predatory behavior. What that adds up to is a great deal of ego at play. "It's awesome," says Founder X. "At work," he explains, "you're well-funded, you have relative traction. Outside work, why do I have to compromise? Why do I have to get married? Why do I have to be exclusive? If you've got a couple of girls interested in you, you can set the terms and say, 'This is what I want.' You can say, 'I'm happy to date you, but I'm not exclusive.' These are becoming table stakes for guys who couldn't get a girl in high school." His overall plan is this: "I'll sell my company in my 30s, settle down, and have kids in my 40s. Furthermore, these elite founders, CEOs, and VCs see themselves as more influential than most hot shit bankers, actors, and athletes will ever be. "We have more cachet than a random rich dude because we make products that touch a lot of people," says Founder X. "You make a movie and people watch it for a weekend. You make a product and it touches people's lives for years. If I'm Miranda Kerr, the very successful lingerie model, I'd think Evan Spiegel, the co-founder of Snapchat who's now Kerr's husband, is a much more durable bet than Orlando Bloom, the actor who's now Kerr's ex-husband." Bloom is only a handsome, highly paid actor, Founder X points out. That can hardly compare with Spiegel. He's a billionaire and he's got an empire. At least on the financial level, Founder X has a point. The payouts of A-list actors and the wolves of Wall Street just aren't that impressive among the Silicon Valley elite. Managing directors at top-tier investment banks may pocket $1 million a year and be worth tens of millions after a long career. Early employees at tech firms like Uber, Airbnb, and Snapchat could make many times that amount of money in a matter of years. Celebrities such as Ashton Kutcher, Jared Leto, and Leonardo DiCaprio have jumped on that power train and now make personal investments in tech companies. The basketball great Kobe Bryant started his own venture capital firm. LeBron James has rebranded himself as not just an athlete, but also an investor and entrepreneur. With famous actors and athletes wanting to get into the tech game, it's no surprise that some in the Valley have a high opinion of their attractiveness and what they should expect or deserve in terms of their sex lives. In the Valley, this expectation is often passed off as enlightened, a contribution to the evolution of human behavior. From many women who describe it, however, it's a new immaturity, sexist behavior dressed up with a lot of highfalutin talk that reinforces traditional power structures, demeans women, and boosts some of the biggest male egos in history. Just another manifestation of brotopia. One clue that this is far from evolved behavior would be the ubiquitous drug use. "When you're on that many drugs, it puts you in that mindset where you're not making good decisions," one female entrepreneur told me. "At the end of the day, there are reasons why drugs are illegal. It makes you fucking crazy, and after all the drug stuff is over, it feels quite empty." There's a huge morality issue in Silicon Valley, and at the very core, it's people with money, thinking they can get away with everything. A lot of these guys got lucky, became billionaires on paper, and so they feel they're kings of the universe. This stuff happens everywhere, but at least it's kind of shamed in New York. In Silicon Valley, for some reason, it's not just okay, it's cool. When I spoke about Silicon Valley's sex parties, specifically those where women vastly outnumber men, with Elizabeth Sheff, a Chattanooga-based writer and professor who has spent 2 decades researching open relationships, her reaction was heated. "That's exploitation. That's old-school, fucked-up, masculine arrogance and borderline prostitution," she said. "The men don't have to prostitute themselves because they have the money. I should be able to have sex with a woman because I'm a rich guy? That is not even one particle progressive. That is the same tired bullshit. It's trying to blend the new and keeping the old attitudes, and those attitudes are based in patriarchy, so they come at the expense of women." Jennifer Russell, who runs the established Camp Mystic at Burning Man, is more sympathetic. Men and women are equally drawn to creating a structure that invites their full sexual expression, and events like this are a safe place to dabble, she says. It's way better than a swingers club would feel because this is at a home and you're surrounded by people you know. Married VC admits, however, that for many men, these parties aren't so much about self-expression than they are about simply sport fucking. Some guys will whip out their phones and show off the trophy gallery of girls they've hooked up with, he says. Maybe this is behavior that happened on Wall Street all the time, but in a way, they owned it. These founders do this, but try not to own it. They talk about diversity on one side of their mouth, but on the other side, they say all of this shit. The new paradigm for women getting screwed. For successful women in Silicon Valley, the drug and sex party scene is a minefield to navigate. This isn't a matter of Bay Area tech women being more prudish than most. I doubt history has ever seen a cohort of women more adventurous or less restrained in exploring sexual boundaries. The problem is that the culture of sexual adventurism now permeating Silicon Valley tends to be more consequential for women than for men, particularly as it relates to their careers in tech. Take multi-time entrepreneur Esther Crawford, who's familiar with sex parties, specifically those with an equal gender ratio and strict rules around consent, and talks freely about her sexual experiments and open relationships. For the last 4 years, she's been in a non-monogamous, they say monogamish, relationship with Chris Messina, a former Google and Uber employee best known for inventing the hashtag. At the time we last spoke, Crawford and Messina had decided to start a company together, called Molly, perhaps not uncoincidentally the same name as the drug. A non-judgmental, artificially intelligent friend who will support your path to more self-awareness. They also chose to become monogamous for a while. It was getting too complicated. The future of relationships is not just with humans, but AI characters, Crawford told me. By December 2017, they had raised $1.5 million for their new company. In the meantime, Crawford is acutely aware of the harsh reality that as a female entrepreneur, she faces so many more challenges that men don't. What she's found is that for a woman, pushing private sexual boundaries comes with a price. When Crawford was raising funds for her second company, a social media app called Glimpse, she went to dinner with an angel investor at a hip restaurant on San Francisco's Valencia Street. At the end of the meal, he handed her a check for $20,000, then immediately tried to kiss her. I certainly wasn't coming on to him, she asserts. I kind of leaned back and he ordered me an Uber and I was like, I gotta go home. Crawford thinks it's likely that this particular investor knew about her sexual openness and found it difficult to think of her simply as an entrepreneur rather than as a potential hookup. This encounter is an example of a unique penalty women face if they choose to participate in the we're all cool about sex scene. Ava was working as an executive assistant at Google when she ran into her married boss at a bondage club in San Francisco. He was getting a blowjob from a woman strapped to a spanking bench who was being entered by another man from behind. Ava and her boss, an engineer, locked eyes, but didn't exchange a word and never spoke of the encounter again. However, a few months later, at a Google offsite event, another married male colleague approached her. He hits on me and I was like, what are you doing? Don't touch me. Who are you again? He was like, I know who you are. The other guy said you like all this stuff. Someone had outed Ava. She quit working at Google shortly thereafter. The trust works one way, Ava says. The stigma for a woman to do it is so much higher. I'm supposed to be in this industry where everyone is open and accepting, but as a woman, the punishment is so much more unknown. Crawford can't even count the number of men who've told her how lucky she is to have so many eligible men to date in the male-dominated tech scene. Of all the privileges in the world, that is not the one that I would choose, she says fiercely. I'd choose equal pay for equal work. I'd choose having better access to capital and power. I'd choose not being passed over for promotions. I'd choose not having to worry about being in the 23.1% of undergraduate college women who get sexually assaulted. I'd choose not being slut-shamed if I do opt to explore my sexuality. While Crawford supports the idea that consenting adults should be able to form the kinds of relationships that work for them, she says, those who are in positions of power need to be a lot more thoughtful about how and who they engage with in their free time. It's such a small ecosystem, and the power dynamics between VCs and founders adds a layer of complexity that everyone has to be aware of. It's never okay for a VC to flirt with or proposition a female founder, or a female colleague for that matter. Married VC admits he might decline to hire or fund a woman he's come across within his sex partying tribe. If it's a friend of a friend or you've seen them half naked at Burning Man, all these ties come into play, he says. Those things do happen. It's making San Francisco feel really small and insular because everybody's dated everybody. Men actually get business done at sex parties and strip clubs, but when women put themselves in these situations, they risk losing credibility and respect. Women can eschew the party scene, of course, but those who do end up running a different risk. That's what Lisa Yu discovered when she started her first company, Office Book, with the aim of becoming the Airbnb of office space. Just after she launched, she was invited to a penthouse party hosted by a powerful angel investor who had made his fortune as an early employee at eBay. There, she met a wealthy investor. He was super friendly, and he was listening to my idea, and he was like, wow, I want to connect you to my business partner. She says he then flashed her a few pictures of his own mansion and his yacht, where, he bragged, he hosted parties of his own. Yu dismissed the yacht photos as unsubtle self-promotion and focused instead on the suggestion that he might provide some value to her company. I'm thinking, wow, this could actually be a business partnership. The next day, Yu says she received a text from this investor inviting her to dinner on his boat. I'm like, okay, this is odd, Yu says. I politely declined and he brushed it off, like, no worries. But the investor apparently wasn't as cool about the rejection as he wanted to seem. A few days later, Yu attended a birthday party for investor Jonathan Teo. For Yu, it was an opportunity to meet new potential backers and hang out with her female founder friends. Then she ran into Yacht Guy again. I was like, oh crap, Yu recalls. She managed to avoid him until the end of the night when he cornered her and started yelling, claiming that she had missed out on a business opportunity by rejecting his earlier invitation. Yu said she was petrified. I felt attacked and I was scared. When a drunk man is yelling at you and cornering you, what do you do? A girlfriend cut in between them, saying, are you interested in Lisa or her business? Because you're making it very confusing. Yacht Guy then unsubtly pivoted, trying to persuade both of them to attend the night's after party. I'm just imagining what's happening at the mansion, drugs and orgies, Yu tells me. We're like, okay, we're getting out of here. At home, she says, I stayed up crying and talking and eating ramen until 3 a.m. I just felt so defeated. I almost wanted to give up on my business. If this is what it takes to start a business, I don't know if I want to do this. Meeting tech investors requires a certain amount of socializing, but this kind of interaction is not what she signed up for. If you go to these parties, you're just asking to be objectified. Sometimes you don't even know what you're getting yourself into. You don't know. Is it going to be shady or not? Rather than give up, Yu paused her fundraising conversations and focused on building her business organically. I went into grind mode. I focused on customers, and within a few months we were profitable, she says proudly. She knows the stronger her business is, the more money she can raise on her own terms, which means no need for shady investor parties. They invite me to these things, but I refuse to go because I know what happens, Yu says. The party scene is now so pervasive that women entrepreneurs say turning down invitations relegates them to the uncool kids table. It's very hard to create a personal connection with a male investor, and if you succeed, they become attracted to you, one told me. They think you're part of their inner circle, and in San Francisco, that means you're invited to some kind of orgy. I couldn't escape it here. Not doing it was a thing. Rather than finding it odd that she would attend a sex party, said this entrepreneur, people would be confused about her not attending. The fact that you don't go is weird, the entrepreneur said, and it means being left out of important conversations. They talk business at these parties. They do business, she said. They decide things. Ultimately, this entrepreneur got so fed up that she moved herself and her startup to New York and left Silicon Valley for good. The women who do say yes to these parties rarely see a big business payoff. There is a desire to be included and invited to these kinds of things, and sometimes it felt like it was productive to go and you could get ahead faster by cultivating relationships in this way, one female tech worker told me. Over time, I realized that it's false advertising, and it's not something women should think is a way to get ahead. It's very risky. Once you're in that circle, once you decide you want to play the game, you can't back out. If you really believe that's going to get you to a serious place in your career, that's delusion. Another female entrepreneur described the unfair power dynamic that's created. There is this undercurrent of feeling like you're prostituting yourself in order to get ahead because, let's be real, if you're dating someone powerful, it can open doors for you, and that's what women who make the calculation to play the game want. But they don't know all the risks associated with it, she said. If you do participate in these sex parties, don't ever think about starting a company or having someone invest in you. Those doors get shut. But if you don't participate, you're shut out. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. For women in Silicon Valley, if you aren't at these weekend bacchanals, you're missing out on potentially useful connections, not to mention being marginalized as prudish and uncool. If you are there, you're gossiped about and reduced to a notch on a bedpost. Meanwhile, the powerful men who claim to be overturning the establishment are instead becoming age-old examples of the worst of it, shaming women for the very same behavior they give themselves and their buddies a pass for. They might as well be sad imitations of Don Draper and Roger Sterling, sniggering over martinis about the secretaries they've shagged. They're not expanding boundaries, no matter how many times they go to Burning Man or how many drugs they take. Whether they were nerds or not in their teen years, they've now become the worst stereotype of the jock, frat boy, and banker they dismissed. Great companies don't spring magically to life when a nerd gets laid 3 times in a row. Great companies are built in the office, with hard work put in by a team. The problem is that weekend views of women, as sex pawns and founder hounders, can't help but affect weekday views of women as colleagues, entrepreneurs, and peers. Hacking monogamy. Remember Susan Fowler, the former Uber engineer who blogged that her manager brought up his non-monogamous relationship as a way to make a pass at her over the internal company chat system? It's worth repeating what she wrote in her viral essay. He was in an open relationship, he said, and his girlfriend was having an easy time finding new partners, but he wasn't. Open and polyamorous relationships, like the one Fowler's manager described, are on the rise among many tech workers in Silicon Valley, but not working out to everyone's satisfaction. As Fowler experienced, this new landscape of non-monogamous dating can infect the workplace with varying results. Uber's response seemed to suggest that the manager's invitation to be part of his open sex life was not a big deal. The company, according to Fowler, told her that it wouldn't be comfortable punishing the manager for what was probably just an innocent mistake. That tepid response from HR may not be surprising, given that open relationships were being explored at the highest levels of the Uber organization. At the time, then-CEO Travis Kalanick was dating Gabby Holzwat, a violinist. Holzwat entered the Silicon Valley scene when Uber investor Shervin Pishavar hired her to play at a fundraiser at his home for soon-to-be Senator Cory Booker in 2013. That's where Holzwat first met Kalanick. Sparks flew, but what she says she didn't realize is that Kalanick didn't want a traditional relationship. Over a year after the pair broke up, Holzwat shared with me details of their years together, including moments when Kalanick mixed business with pleasure. She shed light on a story that originally broke in The Information of the night when Kalanick joined a group of Uber executives that included the company's head of business, Emil Michael, on a visit to an escort karaoke bar in Seoul. The girls were sitting in the center of this ring, shivering in miniskirts, Holzwat recalled. Each woman had a numbered tag so they could be chosen by the men in the group for a more personal encounter. A female Uber executive, who was also in the group at the time, later reported it to HR, and said the incident made her feel horrible. Holzwat said that Michael called her to ask her not to discuss the night publicly, although Michael has countered that he was only calling to let her know that reporters may try to contact her directly, as a series of post-Fowler stories about Uber began to break in the news. Feeling he was trying to bully her into silence, she instead became the whistleblower. It was not the only story she told. In October 2017, she posted on Facebook, "For all the women who are trying to fit in, you don't have to hunt for women to bring back for them to fool around with. No, you don't have to rate other women's bodies, call them too ugly or fat to hang out with. No, you don't have to sit around as you hear them compare the number of women they have slept with at one time." When I called Holzwat to ask what she was referring to, she said that Kalanick regularly encouraged her to find other women to bring into threesomes. She also told me that Kalanick and Michael talked openly in her presence about their sexual adventures. Travis surrounded himself with men who liked that lifestyle. It was easier for them to get close to him, Holzwat told me. A company culture is formed by what people at the company actually say and do together. The norms, standards, and values they collectively uphold. When the two most senior and important leaders of a company are party to women being treated as objects, as Kalanick and Michael were in that bar in Seoul, it is not hard to imagine how this might poison company culture and lead cases like Susan Fowler's to be overlooked. Again, an external investigation documented 47 claims of sexual harassment at Uber. I reached out to Emil Michael about 5 months after he had left Uber, on the heels of Holder's investigation. In a statement, he was both defensive and apologetic, clearly affected by the public reaction to Uber's cultural unraveling and his role in it. He told me that he worked hard to build a diverse team, including women, at Uber, and said he deeply regretted attending and failing to prevent the visit to the South Korean bar. "My lack of judgment on that evening did not represent my values," he told me. "I have learned a lot since those early days about the obligations that I and all leaders have to lead by example in situations like this, and the lasting impact that decisions, both good and bad, can have on any organization." The spectrum of open relationships in Silicon Valley is broad. Polyamory, on one extreme, is defined as the state of being in love with, or romantically involved with, more than one person at the same time. Polyamory shares the same Latin root as polygamy, the practice of having more than one mate at the same time. But while polygamy is generally rejected in the Western world, polyamory has become a widely accepted social trend, at least in the Bay Area. There are no hard numbers on how many local residents have adopted, often loosely, the tenets of polyamory, but experts I've talked to feel safe to say that a significant majority of those who do are tech workers. Sociologist Elizabeth Sheff has been studying polyamory since long before it was trendy in Silicon Valley. She says that most polyamorists nationwide are highly educated, middle and upper middle class white people who have the freedom to experiment and the means to hire a good lawyer if things end badly. "In the tech industry specifically, I think people think a lot about what is possible," Sheff says. "If your mind is constantly like, things don't have to be this way, or it could be any way at all, let me think of a new way, then you also start questioning not just binary code, but binary relationships, heterosexual relationships, and marriage." "Polyamory is a hack," says Twitter co-founder Evan Williams. To be clear, not his kind of hack. "It's trying to solve the problem of love and security and excitement and novelty. It's popular here because people see it as a smarter way to live." Candace Locklear is a partner at the tech public relations firm Mighty, which counts Facebook, Twitter, and Pandora among its clients. "When I met her in 2016, she and her husband had been dating another couple for 2 years. She was sleeping with the other man. Her husband was sleeping with that guy's wife. We're all on WhatsApp. There's a lot of coordination. We have date nights where we swap houses," Locklear told me. The rule when they started was, don't fall in love. "Well, fuck," she said, "everybody fell in love." Locklear asserted that the experience had only made her marriage stronger because she fell in love with her husband all over again by seeing him through another woman's eyes. Yes, they do have kids, and their kids, 6 and 12 years old at the time, are in on what's happening to the extent they can understand. Locklear does worry about how this unconventional love quadrangle may affect her preteen daughter. The younger child belongs to the other couple, but said she's constantly trying to explain and give her as much attention as possible. To clarify, there is an important distinction between polyamory and everything else that falls under the non-monogamy umbrella. For example, you and your partner might be monogamish, like Crawford and Messina, meaning the two of you agree you can see other people, but there are certain rules. For one couple, the rule might be that it's fine to get a little handsy if you stay above the belt. Another couple might countenance one-off hookups or casual side relationships with third parties. Polyamory is different in that it involves deep emotional connections, as in Locklear's situation, rather than simply sex with multiple partners. Adherents believe that love is infinite and that you can feel love for multiple people at the same time. They call it committed non-monogamy. For these reasons, most polyamorists don't like being compared to 1970s swingers. Advocates describe what they're doing as a brave experiment in human connection. But what happens when the workplace becomes the lab they're experimenting in? Though the tech community didn't invent polyamory, it has certainly adapted it. There's reportedly even a poly meetup group at Google. But Susan Fowler's case is just one example of how the "we're so cool about sex" culture can create confusion that can bleed into the workplace and foster an uncomfortable power dynamic. Chris Messina was still working at Uber when Fowler's blog post hit. After it happened, I had people ask me about it, and I'm like, whoa, whoa, I'm not condoning the rest of this stuff because I've chosen this lifestyle, Messina told me. I see a lot of people looking for excuses for bad behavior. Oh, I can fuck whoever I want, whenever I want. No, it's not okay to do this at work. All the same rules apply. What I'm concerned about is the whole trend around non-monogamy becomes another justification for not being responsible for yourself, and that's not the point. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. And it creates an environment where, specifically as a woman, you can't get a break. Elizabeth Sheff says the rise of polyamory and other forms of non-monogamy can have especially dangerous professional consequences for women if their workplace is already dominated by men. You can't assume that people will understand that you're off the market because you're married or in a relationship, she says. Navigating that, being on the market even though you're married, can be exhausting, especially for women who don't have as much power in the workplace. Now it takes more effort to patrol that boundary. Being on the market never stops. There's often a social cost to refusing the endless offers or expressing more traditional views that sexual relationships should be monogamous. It comes across as parochial and prudish in certain settings, says Sheff. The Uber example, for Sheff, represents how this evolution in various types of relationships can lend cover for a new type of sexual harassment. That's not polyamory, that's fucked up, she told me when we discussed Fowler's story. It's just inappropriate to put people in that position in the workplace. You may think you're Steve Jobs, but really you're Roger Ailes or Bill O'Reilly with a Bernie Sanders tattoo. Even a woman who is non-monogamous herself could have problems. If a woman is known to be polyamorous, then there's this assumption, like, of course she'll date, Sheff says. And if she won't engage, then she's a frigid bitch. Women can be at a double disadvantage around this because they still get the sideways looks from other women and from men who think, well, you're slutty, why don't you fuck me? One female tech worker who's open-minded told me that her go-to excuse to gently fend off unwanted advances from male colleagues is to tell them she prefers to date women, which is only half true. Finally, even when all parties consent to some sort of open arrangement, Sheff says men are more frequently the instigators. If they're an established couple and one of them says, let's become polyamorous, very frequently it's the man. Definitely that's a dynamic where the man is like, oh come on honey, let's do this, she says. But sometimes it doesn't work out quite the way the man expected. Once couples finally start, it's often easier for the woman to get dates. That appears to have been the situation of the manager who harassed Fowler. Sheff is no prude. She believes that the modern form of polyamory, in fact, gives women more power, and that some women are the instigators in their relationships. Every traditional society that we know of, wealthy men get as many women as they want. I'm talking China, France, Mongolia, Peru, Canada, everywhere. If you're a rich guy in 300 BC or 2075, you get multiple women. The huge difference now is that women can also have multiple partners. Not all polyamorous relationships are empowering for women, but they're certainly not all exploitative. Finding love and keeping love has puzzled humans through the ages, and one might be a little impressed by the bravery and innovation that this generation of tech workers brings to the challenge. But there is so little separation in tech offices between social life and work life and the power dynamics at play that the romantic confusion created by polyamory and non-monogamy is seeping into the office, increasing tension and opportunities for misunderstandings. Conference Room G. San Francisco has long been a place of sexual norm-breaking. It was a club in the city's North Beach district that is credited in the 1960s with pioneering topless dancing. That style of entertainment, now with the added titillation of private lap dances, seems somewhat old-fashioned. Still, when I heard there was a downtown strip club that was often packed midday with young men from the tech industry, I threw on a pair of sunglasses and decided to make a visit myself. My trip to the Gold Club on San Francisco's Howard Street began at 11:45 a.m. on a Friday. The place is already hopping, and by noon there's not a seat left in the joint, and the buffet line wraps around the perimeter of the room. One reason is that this may well be the cheapest lunch in San Francisco. Just pay the $5 cover charge, and the rest is free. All you can eat mountains of meaty fried chicken, thick juicy ribs, chicken taquitos, and a generous dessert tray. The other reason the Gold Club is packed, unlimited topless entertainment. I take a seat at a table near the back with a female colleague I have coerced into joining me on this awkward reporting excursion, feeling more than a little naive and dumbstruck. The Gold Club is the lone strip joint in the tech-heavy Soma district, just a block from the Moscone Center, which hosts the biggest technology conferences in the world. Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, Salesforce's Dreamforce, and Oracle Open World. Yelp is just blocks away, as is LinkedIn's brand new 26-story skyscraper. One step into the Gold Club and you feel as if you've been transported to a Las Vegas nightclub, LED lights and all. But this isn't your usual late-night casino crowd. Construction workers on their lunch breaks sit next to men in suits and tech engineers in hoodies and t-shirts. In some of these groups, a woman or two has tagged along. At the center of it all, a half-naked dancer shimmies up and down a 15-foot pole on the main stage. Around noon, the hostesses start weaving through the tables, catching the eyes of customers who might want something more intimate than the fried chicken. The Gold Club appears to be staffed so there's a woman for everyone. Black, blonde, Asian, Latina, tall and short, big and small-bosomed, tattooed, and au naturel. When a dancer wearing a gleaming white bra and underwear approaches our table, I introduce myself and confess that I'm there to do some reporting. She introduces herself with the stage name Zora Rose and tells me she's a teacher at a public middle school in Berkeley, doing summer day shifts at the club to help pay bills. She says she's met patrons from all of the brand-name tech companies nearby, specifically mentioning Uber, Dropbox, Twitter, and Airbnb. Salesforce is big here, she adds. Yelp employees call this place Conference Room G. I ask Rose what exactly is on the menu, besides the dancing and buffet. She tells me that most of the place clears out after lunch, so you know that the people who are still here want something more. Besides lunch, nothing's cheap at the Gold Club. It costs $10 just to withdraw money from the on-premise ATM. A lap dance costs $20, $60, or $100, depending on how long it runs and how naked the dancer gets. Or you can just go all out and book 30 minutes in a back room for $375. Every girl decides how far they want to go back there, one dancer told me. I'm sure there's all kinds of things going on. Another dancer confirmed that sex is available for those with the cash. Rose says she definitely attracts a particular type of man. I get all the mid-40s, white, married tech execs, she explains. Compared with Chicago, where she used to perform for mostly lawyers, doctors, and salesmen, her tech clients in San Francisco are much more interested in having a conversation, in addition to all the other stuff. Basically, they just want a stripper girlfriend for a few hours, Rose says. I call it therapy in a sexy outfit. Another dancer, Nikki Darling, agreed to chat with me later by phone. She, too, estimates that male tech workers are the predominant clientele. Sometimes a group will come in and guys are like, oh yeah, that's my boss that I'm with. Business deals happen here all day long, she says. After all, it's much easier to close a sale when everyone's in a really, really good mood. Darling tells me she has two regulars whom she sees outside the club, including a Google employee who's single and a venture capitalist who's married. While some of her tech clientele are nice guys, she's also encountered her share of Silicon Valley jerks. They're younger, came into money early, and it makes them act kind of douchey, kind of a bit entitled, Darling says. They have money or power and know you want their money, and they use that power dynamic in a not-so-nice way. In case it isn't clear from the description above, going to strip clubs isn't something just a couple of guys in the office are doing once in a while. In certain companies, it rises to the level of a corporate culture that is, in some cases, approved by the men at the very top, with strip club fees being charged back to the company. Strip clubs are nothing new to business, and they've been part of hard-charging tech culture since at least Trilogy's heyday in the 1990s. The CEO, Joe Lamont, a.k.a. $100 Joe, led young, impressionable employees on pilgrimages to Las Vegas, where gambling and naked women were the main event. Krista Quarles, now the CEO of OpenTable, was taken to the Gold Club at the end of an interview, a job interview, with another tech company. It was more like, hey, everyone, let's go out and see if this person is a social fit, Quarles remembers. She felt it was clearly part of the interview, a sort of test to see if she could, as she puts it, hang with the bro culture. Despite feeling uncomfortable, Quarles didn't complain. I felt like what I needed to do to be successful was being one of the boys, she says. Quarles ultimately took herself out of the running for that job and kept looking. Another female founder told me she once shared office space with a male entrepreneur who met friends for the Gold Club buffet weekly. It became such a normal part of his routine that he took new employees to the club for their orientation lunch, including men and women. What employees do on their own time is, of course, their business. But without a doubt, attending strip clubs with colleagues during the workday is lethal to company culture. Many of the tech workers who engage in this behavior don't seem to realize it's problematic. One founder and investor told me he's been to the Gold Club at least 5 times with his friends, who also happen to be his co-founders. When I pointed out that outings like this might have influenced the startup's bro-y culture, he agreed. It was hard for us to hire women. We didn't hire women, and we've tried to be very cognizant of not fucking that up anymore. I'm not a saint in this story, the founder admitted. When I told LinkedIn's co-founder Reid Hoffman about the tech employees' regular outings to Conference Room G, he simply said, "That is not good." Does it matter that they are regularly visiting strip clubs and attending sex parties if it's happening outside the workplace? I asked. "Yes, of course it does," he said. "We are the habits that we create. You have an extra burden to make sure that's not screwing with your workplace." Visiting strip clubs becomes especially problematic when it becomes a test for who is on the team. If the woman is on a job interview, refusing to go will certainly damage her chances of getting the job. But even for women who are already part of the staff, the strip club invitation is a lose-lose proposition. They can either participate and potentially feel humiliated and awkward in front of their colleagues, or decline and miss the group bonding and business conversation that will take place there. Uber engineer Ana Medina says she was issued an open invite to accompany her co-workers to the Gold Club, and I never took it, she says. Other engineers asked me to go to bondage clubs and bars, and it was one of those things that I was like, what is this, a San Francisco thing or a Tech Valley thing? Or is this company so fucked up that this is what gets talked about? Of course, sometimes women aren't invited to begin with. One female founder told me that every time she went to a conference with her team, a group of men would venture off on their own. At some point in time, everyone would disappear and I was left. You'll never know how much business happens in those venues, this founder said. Like the high-end sex parties, the strip club scene is part of the background noise that women in Silicon Valley have to deal with. It's a practice that often leaves women in an untenable position. There's no parallel problem for men. Work and private lives are mixed together in Silicon Valley, and the new sexual adventurism inevitably informs how male-dominated workforces perceive the few women in their midst. As one Bay Area sex therapist told me, women are seen as sexual objects, and their objectification is everywhere. Chapter 7. One Hack Doesn't Fit All. How Tech Disrupts Family. In 2014, Facebook and Apple simultaneously decided to offer their female employees what appeared to be the ultimate life hack, all expenses paid. The companies would now cover the cost, up to $20,000, for women to freeze their eggs, literally putting their fertility on ice. At the time, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg told me the idea for the benefit came about when a young female employee, who had recently been diagnosed with cancer, confessed she would never be able to have children unless she froze her eggs before starting treatment. "I talked about it with our head of HR and said, 'God, we should cover this,'" Sandberg told me on Bloomberg TV in 2015. "And then we looked at each other and said, 'Why would we only cover this for women with cancer? Why wouldn't we cover this more broadly?'" After Facebook and Apple set the example, Google jumped on board too. It wasn't long before Intel, Spotify, and Salesforce also offered this new perk. On its face, this was a generous and genuine attempt to give women employees more choice and an ingenious way to attract and retain female talent in an industry starved of women. Haven't yet met the right partner? Or just not ready to have kids? Or maybe right now you just want to focus on your career? For any woman worried about her biological clock, here was a snooze button. Egg freezing is just one example of how the tech industry has addressed the thorny issue of work-life balance. In fact, some tech folks are actively pushing back on the idea of balance as ideal, because it's nearly impossible to achieve. Instead, advancing terms like work-life blend or integration. In an era when companies seem to be demanding more of their employees' time than ever, Silicon Valley offers in return not only generous salaries and stock options, but incentives and hacks to make work obsession both easier to indulge in and more enjoyable. At most established tech firms, free food and alcohol are givens, and they're advertised as selling points. We take care of the details so you can focus on what's really important. You never have to think about what's for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, Dropbox boasts on its website. We're always looking for ways to take the stress out of each day. Facebook and Google have masseuses, doctors, dentists, even hairdressers on call at their headquarters. Ping pong and foosball tables are ubiquitous. Some companies offer fitness classes on site, discounts on gym memberships, and a laundry service for your dirty gym clothes. Others encourage employees to bring their pets to work and give discounts on dog walking, pet insurance, and pet supplies. While some of these benefits would appeal to any employee, many skew for the young and single. So many perks, yet daycare isn't on the list. Few employers offer stipends for childcare, and even fewer provide on-site childcare. Sure, you can bring your dog to work, but you're mostly on your own with your baby. That's because Silicon Valley companies have largely been created in the image of their mostly young, mostly male, mostly childless founders. They don't call their offices campuses for nothing. Facebook employees tell me that although Sandberg has had an immeasurable effect on the company culture, Facebook's website makes a point to emphasize it wants to help employees thrive at all stages of life. To a certain extent, the campus will always feel a little bit like a 19-year-old's dorm room. Google is slightly more mature, a hangout for single PhD candidates. With no kids waiting at home, many young, single employees just out of college are susceptible to making work life their entire life, a tendency the companies are happy to enable. Thanks to the seemingly generous perks they provide, you don't have to leave the Google or Facebook campus except to go home and sleep. At some startups, I've heard employees skip home altogether by keeping cots under their desks. Along with working in a creative environment with brilliant people, you get to play in the ping pong tournament or enjoy a massage at lunch, grab a free beer from the company fridge, and ride the Wi-Fi-enabled company bus home. The last one leaves the Google campus in Mountain View at 10:30 p.m., which lands you in bed in your San Francisco loft by midnight. For the right person, at the right life stage, it can be heaven. But women 35 and up are usually not that person, and the usual perks of the job do not address the reasons so many women in that age group decide to leave. Tech's leaky bucket. Women leave tech much faster than men do, and at an alarming rate. One study found women are more than twice as likely to quit tech than men. Women also leave tech jobs much faster than non-tech jobs. In 2013, researchers found that after 12 years, 50% of women have left STEM jobs to work in other fields. In contrast, only 20% of women in other professional fields left over the course of the study, some whose careers spanned 30 years. While 80% of women in STEM fields say they love their jobs, 32% say they were likely to quit within a year. Many women cite the reasons we've already discussed in this book for leaving: unfairness, lack of advancement, hostile macho culture, feelings of isolation. This fight-or-flight moment also happens to coincide with critical childbearing and child-rearing years. But how much of the leaky bucket problem has to do with an unfulfilling balance or integration of work and life? In a comprehensive report, What's So Special About STEM?, researchers found that family demands affect women in STEM fields far more dramatically than women in other professions. In fact, that staying married and having a second child significantly increased the odds of women exiting the STEM labor force, a trend that's exacerbated the more hours they work. Accounting for various differences in family situations, they found that women in STEM, most of those surveyed were engineers or computer specialists, were 807% more likely to leave their jobs than their peers in other fields. They're not leaving the labor force, but are taking jobs in other industries, and once they leave STEM, they rarely come back. What's disturbing, the researchers point out, is that women in STEM often make more money than women in other fields and often have more egalitarian views about gender roles at home, meaning that we might expect to see women staying in STEM jobs longer than in other roles. Instead, the reverse is true, suggesting that there are several features of these jobs that make them difficult to combine with family life and that the difficulty intensifies as women move up in the hierarchy. In a recent survey, women engineers noted work-family imbalance as one of the top reasons for leaving the industry. Women leave tech at every stage of the game, but the exodus of women in their 30s is particularly unfortunate, given that those are prime years in the tech world. You're old enough to have some serious experience, but still considered young enough to be connected to the latest industry trends. Ageism is yet another bias in tech. This is a period where people in established firms move into positions of real influence. Research by the Founder Institute shows that for an entrepreneur, being older correlates to a higher chance of success, up to age 40, after which age has no effect. Though we've romanticized the cult of the young founder, stories like Mark Zuckerberg's are the exception and not the rule. The stereotype of computer engineers working 60 to 80 hours a week is no myth, and many still believe that for a Silicon Valley tech firm to be successful, programmers must put in superhuman hours. This belief is as baked into Silicon Valley as the stereotype of the boy genius. But now is the time to disrupt that belief, just as tech has disrupted so much of everyone else's life and culture. The Herculean efforts of the Macintosh team, prior to the product's January 1984 release, are still an industry legend. That team's core group of a few dozen programmers were mostly in their 20s and 30s, and few had families or children. A special garment was made up to commemorate their efforts, perhaps the first appearance of the now ubiquitous gray hoodie, and on its back was emblazoned, 90 hours a week and loving it. Such superhuman performance isn't replicated every day in Silicon Valley, but it remains an industry ideal. Take the all-night hackathon in which developers hack together new projects and prototypes. Facebook has held at least 50 since its founding, including one on the night before its 2012 IPO. Day-to-day, however, employees are expected to show their dedication in more quotidian ways, such as taking meals at the office, being connected to their devices after hours, and responding to messages via Slack, the hot intra-office messaging app, late into the evening. Not to mention that Silicon Valley history abounds with tales of CEOs counting cars in the parking lot after 6 p.m. and yelling at staff for not coming in on Sundays. These sorts of attitudes and expectations have given rise to the dude army and to campuses that look like college dorm fantasy lands instead of professional and inclusive workplaces for grown-ups. For many years, Uber served employees a free catered meal, but not until 8:15 p.m. Executives insisted there was no expectation that employees work that late, but even so, whether employees stayed for dinner because they wanted to, had to, felt they should, or simply ended up hanging around, they were still getting out of work well into the evening and long after their kids, if they had found the time to have any, would be asleep. The fancy perks, of course, are mostly at the big companies. At the thousands of small startups just trying to get off the ground, the work hours can be even more brutal, with few extras to speak of except maybe a refrigerator stocked with coconut water, Red Bull, and beer. There's a general nonchalance about retention policies to keep employees engaged over time, and a general urgency to get the maximum amount out of every employee now. After all, pulling off that next product launch or hitting that next milestone could make the difference between getting the next round of funding or shutting down. And tech employees may very well leave, no matter how the boss treats them. According to the job search company Indeed, software engineers in San Francisco have the shortest job tenure, just over 2 years, of software engineers in any metropolitan area, in part because of what Indeed refers to as an especially ambitious workforce and a massive supply of opportunity, with new technologies and companies exploding onto the Valley scene every day. Jobs are gigs, and short stints are common. Between the tech workforce's penchant for switching jobs and the short lifespan of many tech businesses, Silicon Valley hasn't been incentivized to focus on the adult lifespan of its employees. It makes sense for them to provide the brightest and shiniest perks to help get employees in the door. But why invest in creating work-life balance for the long term if your workers are going to move on soon anyway? It's against that long-standing background that the egg-freezing perk has made its appearance. At startups, the approach to pregnancy and maternity benefits is fairly primitive. You're unlikely to encounter a thoughtfully planned parental leave policy, and your eggs will remain unfrozen unless you shell out the money yourself. Most founders don't realize they even need a parental leave policy until the first employee gets pregnant. At the biggest tech companies, however, the situation couldn't be more different. Egg freezing isn't the only benefit large tech firms offer their employees. Sperm banking, extensive IVF treatments, and cord blood banking for newborns are often included, as is support for adoption and surrogacy. Sheryl Sandberg famously